From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Corlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. In the early 1900s, opponents of the Shah wrote a constitution and established a parliament in Iran.
This revolution was then followed by others in Japan, in China, in the Ottoman Empire, in Ireland, etc.
I'll talk with Boston University historian Hushang Shahabi about Iran's brief 20th century experiment with democracy. But first, Rebecca Cruz joins me to talk about some of the positive and negative moments of sportsmanship in the Olympics.
This has turned into what that Russian competitor is calling the new Cold War, and so bringing kind of back this diplomacy issue.
That's all coming up right after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. Rebecca Cruz, here we are back in the studio. And of course, all eyes this week on the Olympics. The Olympics, as we know, are a form of sports diplomacy. It's a way in which countries come together, put their differences aside, hopefully, and athletes can enjoy some good, fun, friendly competition. But we've seen politics play out a little bit this week. The Russians, of course, were allowed to compete after initially the IOC suggesting that they might be banned for what they call systemic and state-sponsored doping of their athletes. But the Russians are competing. They were allowed to compete. The Russian Federation made the decision. But yet they haven't received the best and warmest welcome. A lot of booing of some of the Russian swimmers in particular. The Russians are heading to the media to say this is a Western conspiracy that, you know, that people believe that we've been doping. What is the bottom line here?
Well, yes, some of the Russians were prevented from participating. And in fact, with the Paralympics that come later, all of them were disbanded or not allowed to participate. This looks like it's a large-scale situation the Russian government was involved in. But we can't not blame the IOC in this. They seem to have been given a lot of misinformation or saying one thing and then going in another direction. And so it's caused a lot of confusion. And this probably became most pronounced in the swimming pool. We saw this week the American swimmer wagging her finger at one of her Russian competitors, and this has turned into what that Russian competitor is calling the new Cold War, and so bringing kind of back this diplomacy issue that you mentioned there. Now, this particular case is rather interesting, and this young woman that's representing the Russian team, she's actually from Grozny, so she comes from a war-torn area. She hasn't actually been in Russia. She's been training in California, and she does have a couple of offenses. One of them was likely a mistake that she made when she moved to the United States, and the other, which is probably plays largely into this, is the fact that the IOC recently banned a supplement in January that many of the athletes were taking, and they don't know how long the supplement stays in an athlete's system. So that may be one of the reasons why the IOC is allowing some of the athletes to compete. But it's been a very cold welcome for some of them by the United States, but also by some other athletes that are blaming them. And I would just point out that in a lot of these situations, we saw this with the East Germans in the 1970s, these are governments that are largely responsible for this. The athletes are not blameless, but the governments often will go ahead and do this, often to the detriment of the athletes, as was the case with the East Germans.
Well, as you mentioned, there is a good amount of confusion about what is banned, what isn't, when it was banned, how long it stays in your system.
Yes.
I mean, you try to even you keep up with it, and it's really hard. I imagine athletes have to do their utmost to try to figure out what they can take and what they can't, but it is really confusing and unfortunately creates these sorts of issues. But let's turn to something potentially more heartwarming. And that was the selfie between the North Korean and South Korean gymnast being photographed together in a friendly way. Some suggesting, you know, this is a great outcome of international competition, sporting competition such as this. It would bring these two together. But some have suggested this also has implications potentially for that North Korean gymnast when she returns home. So, you know, what are we to be concerned about this? Is this something that maybe, we should look into in the future and follow that gymnast home?
Well, yes, we should probably keep an eye on her if we're given access to do so. The picture was very lovely, very nice. It probably has the media looking more into it than is there. What she'll face when we go back, we have no idea. Obviously, she lives in a government that is very restrictive and very controlled. In fact, North Koreans have been participating in the Olympics since the 1970s, only excluding a couple in the mid-80s that they boycotted, one in the United States and one in Seoul. But they've been participating, and oddly enough, you've never seen a defection from a North Korean athlete at the Olympics. You see them from other countries that are under these sorts of regimes. So I imagine that she may get a slap on the wrist. If anything, it's a lovely picture, and maybe we should just take it as a lovely picture. But thinking about those athletes representing their country of North Korea, what honors they must get if they do well and go back to the country, as they have every Olympics they've participated in, they have medaled. So what a privilege for them, I suppose.
Well, to be fair, she's been photographed actually hugging many athletes from around the world and even going back many, many years of competition. But it is hard to look past two young women wearing their North Korean and South Korean uniforms and engaging in something friendly. So I think that's maybe a bright spot in this Olympics. But Rio's hanging in there. We continue to watch. And thanks again, Rebecca, for being here.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation and answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. While you're there, you'll find all of our past shows, and you can subscribe to our podcast. You can also check us out on social media. We're on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU and at Suzette Gorlot. Next, I'm joined by Boston University historian Hushang Shahabi. We're going to talk about several of Iran's 20th century revolutionary movements. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. My guest this half hour is Hushang Shahabi. He's an historian at Boston University who studies Middle Eastern politics, cultural history, and international law. He's written several books about Iran's mid-20th century liberation movement, the country's centuries-long relationship with Lebanon, and Iran's 1906 constitutional revolution. Hushang Shahabi, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to begin with your work from a few years ago about the liberation movement in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
As a specialist on Iran, as an Iranian mm-hmm. yourself, born and raised in Iran, tell us about that liberation movement that really began several years ago mm-hmm. and how it's developed over the years.
The liberation movement was a political party. It was a political party formed in 1961. In the liberalization that came about as a result of President John F. Kennedy's initiatives. And the founders of this political party were of the belief that Islam is fully compatible with democracy, so you could call them, if you like, liberal Islamists. And they believed in free elections and a free press, etc. But the life of the party was very short because in 1963, the opening ended and the leadership went into jail. They reemerged at the Iranian Revolution in 1978-79. Most of the leadership of the party was involved in the provisional government that tried to govern Iran between February 79 and November 1979. But when the American hostages were seized, that government resigned, obviously, because they couldn't ensure the safety of diplomats, which is what the government needs to do. And since then, they have been in the opposition to the Islamic Republic.
So they still exist, and they obviously left some legacy. There have been some reforms, some changes that they were responsible for, the constitution, other aspects of Iranian politics and society?
Not really. The constitution, the old constitution was 1906, way before the party was formed in 1961. And the constitution of the Islamic Republic, which dates from 1979, is very much in opposition to everything the party stands for, because the party stands for popular sovereignty, and the constitution of the Islamic Republic is one which is theocratic. So, which is one reason that they have not been allowed to be active politically.
So the constitution as it exists in Iran right now, the bears no resemblance to any kind of previous liberation movement or any aspect at all, purely theocratic.
No. Yep.
So when you've written a book or edited a book on Iran's constitutional revolution, the subtitle, which is Popular Politics, Cultural Transformations, and Transnational Connections, what are you suggesting in that work regarding the constitutional revolution? What are you referring to?
The constitutional revolution in Iran ended the absolute monarchy that had existed in Iran for thousands of years and gave Iran a liberal constitution with a prime minister, elections, a parliament. The Shah became a figurehead. And this was brought about by a popular movement. This was the very first popular movement of the 20th century that brought about a constitution. So, in other words, many layers of society, many strata in society united to try to put an end to arbitrary government. The idea was that even those who rule must obey the law. This revolution was then followed by others. In 1911, we have the Chinese Revolution, and the Chinese revolutionaries, some of them were actually inspired by the Iranian Revolution. They followed events very closely. And so what we try to do in this book is go beyond a blow-by-blow narrative of what happened and look at the social bases of who the revolutionaries were, what they tried to achieve, and most importantly, how they related to constitutionalists elsewhere in the world, in Japan, in China, in the Ottoman Empire, in Ireland, etc.
And we're talking about the 20th century revolution. 1906, 1907. That had an impact on revolutions elsewhere, but also constitutional development elsewhere.
Yes, yes. There were even in Morocco, 2 years later, there was an attempt to install a revolution. And the text that the constitutionalists in Morocco looked at was actually the constitution of Iran, which itself was influenced by other cases. For instance, the 1907 constitution in Iran was based on the Belgian constitution of 1831 with elements from the Bulgarian constitution. So there are really connections between many countries of the world in Asia, in Europe, in Africa, where the same ideas circulate.
Well, are there movements or groups in Iran today that refer back to this period in Iranian
history? Absolutely. All those who reject theocracy, all those who reject clerical rule and who champion popular sovereignty, one of their references is obviously the constitution of 1906-1907. For instance, the liberation movement of Iran that I just mentioned, they would probably be much happier in an Iran governed by the 1906-07 constitution than by the 1979 constitution.
That's Boston University historian Hushang Shahabi. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I've been talking with Hushang Shahabi, an historian at Boston University who studies the political and cultural history of Iran. When we left off, he said many of the groups pushing for reform in Iran draw inspiration from the country's early 20th century constitutional revolution. So what kind of hope do we have for popular movements in Iran today to perhaps bring about this kind of reform and change? I mean, you know, I want to get to Iranian relations in the region and particularly with the United States, but just sticking with Iranian domestic politics now, how likely is it that we can see that sort of movement emerging in Iran? Because, I mean, things are changing. I mean, clearly their relationships are changing, which we're going to get to. So what do you think is for that?
Every now and then movement in that direction occur. For instance, the Green Movement of 2009 was very much a movement in that direction. There are many people in Iran, the so-called reformists, who want to strengthen the republican element in Iran and weaken the clerical element, because Iran currently is not a pure theocracy. I mean, elections matter. The daily lives of people are affected by who wins an election, which means that these elections actually have a political significance, except that there are also lots of unelected officials who can stymie the activities of elected officials. So what the reform movement in Iran tries to do is to strengthen the republican elements of the constitution, thereby weakening the non-democratic elements of the revolution. The Green Movement in 2009 tried to do that. It was repressed. So at this point, people have become much more cautious. And Iranian citizens, most of them, the vast majority of Iranians, don't want another revolution. The revolution was very painful. For everybody. So they don't want another revolution. They are pragmatists. They want to work within the current framework to rebalance the various elements of the political system.
So for lack of a better way of putting it, maybe bottom-up change in Iran is less likely than top-down change, that the government itself or those that are supportive of the theocracy and involved in the theocracy are going to see that it's important for Iran to change in order to enhance its relations with others in the region
for
as well as its domestic
standing. For instance, but for the time being, it's unlikely to happen because that would automatically mean a loss of influence for those whose power is not based on elections. And those circles within the Iranian political system are also the ones who control the courts, the police, the army, the Revolutionary Guards, in other words, the repressive apparatus of the state. And therefore, they are not going to go away without a fight. And the other side is trying everything to avoid a fight.
Well, so from domestic challenges to international ones, then, or regional challenges, you've also written about some of the challenges Iran faces in the 21st century. You've written about Iran's close relationship with Lebanon that goes back many centuries. But it also has, you know, strained relations with others in the region. It's a difficult neighborhood, obviously, as we all know. So tell us a little bit about Iran's relations with its neighbors within its region. It's obviously a regional player and power. And then perhaps we can get to Iran's relationship with the United States and Europe and others around the world as it tries to manage both, as any other big state and important state, its regional relationships and its global relationships.
Yeah, Iran's relationship with its neighbors is a fluctuate over time. For instance, before the presidency of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, which began in 2005, the government really tried to do everything it could to improve relations with its neighbors. Even, for instance, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia visited Tehran, Iranian presidents went to Saudi Arabia and so on. But in the last 10 years or so, relations have really deteriorated quite a bit, which has to do, obviously, also with sectarian tensions in the various countries. And right now, the interesting thing is that Iran is just about the most stable country in the Middle East. Compare Iran with Iraq, with Syria, with Afghanistan. How many refugees leave Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan? In Turkey, the civil war between the government and the Kurds has just started again a few months ago. So this is precisely one of the reasons that people in Iran, those citizens who are unhappy with the political system, don't want upheaval because they look at their neighbors and they say, no, at least we are at peace. So let's not rock the boat too much. But the growth of sectarianism in the Middle East, to which the Islamic Republic has contributed, let's not forget that, by supporting Shiite groups, by funding Shiite militias in Lebanon, for instance, like Hezbollah and so on, has obviously meant that the region is much more less peaceful than it used to be.
Can you comment on its relations with Saudi Arabia, the other major player in the Middle East, obviously a Sunni country versus a Shiite country? I mean, how difficult is that relationship, and how do those two kind of struggle to be the regional hegemon?
Right. Well, both of these states are governed by people who believe that their interpretation of Islam is the best and should be spread around the world. So when the Iranian Revolution occurred in 1979, soon afterwards, the Saudis, and not necessarily talking about the Saudi government, this also includes wealthy individuals or you know, associations and so on, started funding radical Sunni groups in order to rein in the impact of the Iranian Revolution. And so, for instance, in Pakistan, Sunnis and Shiis had lived at peace ever since the founding of the country. But in the early 1980s, sectarianism grows in Pakistan. Relations deteriorate because the Iranians were funding the Shiites of Pakistan, and the Saudis were funding radical Sunni groups who are opposed to Shiis. Right. So, in other words, those countries of the Middle East where you have both Shiis and Sunnis have become arenas for the power play between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Well, so finally, then, we have to mention the relationship between Iran and the United States, which has been undergoing a considerable amount of change over the past year or so. The nuclear agreement that emerged, the United States and its European partners in collaboration with Iran. How hopeful are you, optimistic are you, about improved relations between the United States and Iran continuing on that path and really resulting in a much better environment between the two?
The idea of going beyond the nuclear agreement to achieve a general improvement in Iran's ties with the West and the United States, that idea is opposed by many people in Iran. By all these hardliners that I mentioned, by many elements in the Revolutionary Guards, etc. And let's not forget that those people have ultimate power. The Revolutionary Guards can, if they want to, make life very difficult for the foreign ministry, the president, etc. And there is now talk that the supreme leader of the country, who sides with the hardliners, really wants to make sure that President Rouhani remains a one-term president. Which is precisely because a few weeks ago, in his New Year's speech, President Rouhani alluded to the fact that the nuclear agreement could be followed up by an improvement in other fields as well, economic and so. And immediately the supreme leader came down against this idea.
Dr. Shahabi, thank you so much for being with us today on World
News
to talk
me.
About Iran. You've been listening to my conversation with Boston University historian Hushang Shahabi. You can find more information about his work online at kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews with the support of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Miranda Wilson prepares our research, and Brian Hardzinski produces the show and oversees our digital content. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gralat.